Support for WBFO and What's Next comes from our members and from Health Foundation for Western and Central New York, where racial and socioeconomic health equity are prioritized. Learn more about building healthier neighborhoods at hfwcny.org.
From Buffalo, Toronto Public Media, this is What's Next, an hour dedicated to amplifying the voices of marginalized and underrepresented communities across Western New York and Southern Ontario.
We cannot erase, we cannot reform, we cannot make things better if we're uncomfortable having tough conversations,
Absolutely.
If we're uncomfortable
Absolutely.
Talking about race.
What's Next carries forward our mission to engage in meaningful conversations about race, equity, and the shared concerns that deeply affect Buffalo's East Side and beyond.
Don't stop. Make those families part of your life. Their lives are part of yours. Don't stop.
Together, we dive into the real issues, striving for understanding, connection, and change.
In the suburban area, everywhere, we must work and teach our children.
And welcome back to What's Next. My name is Ekua Menzedu, and today we're taking a closer look at restorative practices in schools and why they're becoming an important part of the conversation in Buffalo right now. Earlier this year, the New York State Attorney General's office issued an assurance of discontinuance to the Buffalo Public School District, raising concerns about disciplinary practices and disparities in how students are treated. In response, schools and community organizations are exploring ways to strengthen school culture, improve accountability, and create environments where students feel supported rather than pushed out. One approach that has gained national attention is restorative practices, strategies designed to repair harm, build relationships, and address conflict in ways that keep students connected to their school communities. Today, joining us is Dina Thompson, Executive Director, and Andy Prinzing, who is a Director of Training from the Erie County Restorative Justice Coalition, an organization that has supported restorative practices in school, including Buffalo Public Schools, for more than a decade. Excited to have you both on.
We're so excited to be here. Thank you so much for having us.
And so for listeners who may be hearing this term for the first time, what exactly are restorative practices and how do they differ from traditional discipline approaches in school?
So I think the first thing is to think about how restorative justice and restorative practices sometimes are used interchangeably. If you think about restorative justice, we're talking about there's been a serious incident of harm, and we want to bring together people who've been impacted, want to focus on the needs of the people who've experienced harm, and we work with the people responsible for the harm to assess their understanding and willingness to repair relationships. And then we have a process to talk about what happened and what people were thinking, and we talk about the impact and create a plan. What we found is that schools can't just do restorative justice because it's hard to repair relationships when people don't feel in relationship. So restorative practices are all the things we do to build connection and community. And I think it's important that we need to first validate what people in schools are doing to build connection and community. But when we do restorative practices training, we're teaching teachers how to facilitate a community building circle in a classroom once a week so the kids can connect with each other. And it's not about the teachers having good relationships only with the kids. It's about the kids having good relationships with each other and creating really supportive environments in every classroom in a school.
So it's relationship building strategies that we import into the school culture. And we think that that is important because people are less likely to harm an environment or a community that they feel a part of.
Yeah, that definitely makes a lot of sense. And so, you know, Dina, I know you've been in this role for some time. You want to give the listeners just a clear view of what your organization does, how you came about, and the work that you do.
Yes. So I'm going to take a deep breath because we are a small nonprofit organization that does a lot. I would say that we are focused really on healing, restoring, and maintaining strong, positive communities. We do that through training in racial healing. We do that through offering opportunities for restorative practices within school systems. So we've worked with six different school districts implementing a restorative practice culture within their community. We run two diversion programs, a three-part series program specifically focused on youth who have stolen cars, and a Leading Our Resilience Every Day diversion program that focuses on juveniles that are in the justice system that are referred to us through probation or family court or through the DA's office. We also do community conversations around issues that are impacting community, or providing language around how do we strengthen and build what is great and working in our community. We train people in the community, in our school system, in organizations around how do we build stronger culture, a positive culture, how do we address issues within the community. We believe that people who are closer to the issues are closer to the solutions, and so we want to create a shared language, a shared vision around that using restorative practice.
That definitely makes sense, and it's a lot that you're doing as you listed those things out, right?
Here we go.
And so we know that the Attorney General recently issued an assurance of discontinuance to the Buffalo Public School District. For those who might not have been following that to date and following that closely, what is that concern that prompted this action?
It's a disproportionality of suspensions. What the Attorney General agreed with, what most parents and students have experienced, is the disproportionality of suspension of students of color, students with disabilities, and also LGBTQ plus. English learner students have really disproportionately experienced suspension because of a lack, I believe, of understanding of the underlying issues that are causing some of the behavior. And so the findings did find that they're seeing Black and brown children being suspended up to six times more than their white counterparts. We see the same thing with our student with disabilities, four times as much, and the same thing with our English learner students as well. And so that raised a lot of concern because we've lost tens of thousands of education hours by being suspended. So if a student is not in school, they're not being educated. They also found out that there is such a different way that people are interpreting the code of conduct. And so it's been very subjective in how they are issuing suspensions around the code of conduct. Each principal has an individualized choice of what they feel that the code of conduct is saying when it comes to discipline. And so it's being very subjective on how they are disciplining and administering discipline. And unfortunately, it is the Black and brown children, children with disabilities, and LGBTQ plus students who are feeling the impact of this.
Do you have anything to add to that, Andy?
Oh, there's so much. I think just acknowledging that, you know, the reasons when you hear about suspensions, you think we're talking about like fights with like physical injuries, and we're talking about like drugs. But really, a lot of these suspensions are for disrespect or insubordination or other disruptive incidences, which really just begs a question, like, can we have a conversation first? And can we acknowledge, talk about what's going on and try to create a plan, as opposed to just removing kids when they're disrupting the instruction of other kids? So it's like, it's a problem when we're doing this because it's so subjective, and ultimately we're denying families and kids their rights to an education. So it's a civil rights issue. And it even leads into other things like just the process. Like, are families being given an opportunity to meet with the principal? Is proper documentation provided in a timely fashion? We can't just send kids home if they're having a bad day.
I would also like to add, when we are servicing students, because that is the job of education, we service students and we service families. And when we're looking at a population that's 87% poverty, there are different underlining needs that we need to meet so that we can meet the academic standards that we have. So if I'm coming to school and I'm unfed, or if I didn't get a good night's sleep, or if I'm concerned about things that happen in my neighborhood, and there's not a resource to be able to address some of these issues, children can't take in more information until we relieve some of the information that we have inside of us out. So restorative practice really provides the time in the day to be able to check in with students to find out, are they okay? are there supports that are needed to help them meet the expectations that we have for them today?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I want to ask a little bit about, you know, what restorative practice actually looks like inside of a school building, mm-hmm. right? And mm-hmm. so on the day-to-day, what do those interactions look like?
Prior to Andy joining our team, he was an administrator in a school, so okay. I'm going to lean on him to just talk a little bit about his experience.
Yeah, so typically, the goal is that every student in a building at least once a week participates in an activity of relationship in community building. So, for example, we all know a lot's happened over the weekend or in the morning or last night. And so we ask the kids, we'll do a check-in. And so people are going to circle up. So we want everyone to be seen and heard. And the facilitator, usually the teacher, or it could be anyone. We have students that lead circles in some districts, but we start by just, we review values and guidelines. An example of like a value would be like respect, honesty, connection, community, trust, and we name some values and ask everyone if we can agree to these values by giving us a thumbs up. And then we review some guidelines and we create a shared space. And then we ask everyone, how are you showing up today? On a scale of 1 through 10, 10's fantastic, 1's horrible, I just want to go back to bed, or somewhere in the middle, maybe I'm a 5 or a 7. And we just accept people for how they're showing up. And then we'll do either some relationship building questions, like what's something you've enjoyed in the past 2 weeks? And we all learn a little bit about each other. And then after a while, once the group starts forming, the trust builds over time, then we can ask deeper questions and people can share on a deeper level. And with deeper sharing comes deeper connections. And over time, if you do this once a week, we're going to see kids are going to feel a stronger sense of belonging. We're going to see less conflict. And also when there is conflict, we can use those relationships and have those conversations around values and guidelines. And so we can become less reliant on needing to put kids in in-school suspension or out of school or other punitive measures that bring kids out of the environment. Because we know the best place for kids is with their teachers and with their peers. Mm-hmm. And so we want to find ways to build the most supportive environment that we can. And it really comes down to our schools. Like when we've worked with schools over 10 years, and one of the biggest obstacles is teachers say, we don't have time to do this. And so it's got to be in the schedule. There has to be like a 20 to 25 minute block, ideally once a week. Just we need to be intentional about community building. And the other part that some schools, we need to remind them, is that the teachers also need to experience community and belonging. We need to check in with the teachers, and they need to experience themselves for they to have this transfer into their classrooms. So really, we need school leadership to model this with the adult staff to show how it works. We need to check in with teachers, how they're doing, and then it can translate into kids. But it can have a profound impact. And when it's happening with fidelity, nationally, we've seen research, and we've also seen it locally, that there can be a reduction in office referrals from between 40 and 80%. We can see suspensions can drop as similarly between 40 and 80%. And what's also exciting is that kids report a higher sense of connection and belonging with their peers and with teachers.
I'm going to give you an example of that because Buffalo Public Schools knows how to do this. As you stated earlier, we've been working with the district over 10 years. I'm going to talk about a story where we worked with the school, Lovejoy Discovery School 43. Back then, it was Principal Ornice Hill. And we worked with the school for a year. In 1 year, we saw a reduction in suspensions by half. And so Principal Ornice Hill was a great advocate and a role model of an administrator that implemented restorative practices with fidelity, meaning that she sent all of her teachers to a 2-day training. So we partnered with the school. We trained the school for 2 days. We came alongside them. We did observations. We co-facilitated circles in the classroom. Principal Hill made sure that it was 20 minutes every single day that each class had to do check-in circles, community building circles. As Andy described, she also made sure that her staff had the training and the resources needed when there were small conflicts that happened, that they could come in and reduce those conflicts through dialogue. And so de-escalate escalating the conflict, bringing students together, having conversations with that together. She was such an advocate of restorative practices that her and her assistant principal would walk around with clipboards in the morning and check and make sure that the teachers were indeed having the circles around. That's the support that teachers needed. Mm-hmm. She was also open to be able to have conversations with their teachers and ask, what supports do you need? Because this is the culture that we want in our school. Mm-hmm. So when we fast forward and we were able to work in other districts, I want to lift up Cheektowaga Sloan Union Free School District. They just received the Erie County Board of Education award for implementing a restorative practice. We have been a partner with them for 8 years, and just some amazing statistics that they have in their school. Not only do their teachers and their support team implement restorative practice and facilitate circles, but so do their students. So their students are trained from third grade to 12th grade to help co-facilitate and run circles. Mm-hmm. They do peer mediation with each other using what we call restorative mats. So the restorative questions are on the mat, and then each student has the opportunity to walk toward each other as they answer the restorative questions and shake hands when they get to the end. So the restorative questions are, what happened? So during a conflict, what happened? What were you thinking at the time? Because it might not even be about the other student. It might have been about something that happened before. Or maybe they're in trauma. I don't even know what I was thinking. But at least the adults around are listening and can respond and support. What have you thought about since? What needs to happen to make things right? So we're giving students the ability to be accountable and responsible for behavior, and what do we need to do to make it right? So it's your responsibility to make this right. So we're giving ownership of the process to the student as the teacher oversees it. So we're teaching problem-solving skills to our students. But through Cheektowaga Sloan doing this, in 2019, when we came to work with them, the middle school had 2,444 referrals. To date, today, as of March 9th, they only have 222. The high school started off with over 1,300 referrals. Today, they have 423. And this is what needs to be celebrated. In 2024-2025 academic school year, there are only two superintendent hearings. Two. Buffalo Public Schools has over 1,000. So this year, they're also on track to only to having the lowest superintendent hearings that they have ever had over the last 8 years. So that's how important, when restorative practice is introduced with fidelity, if people are trained, if people have the support, if people are dedicating the time, the talent, and I will say the treasure to be able to implement this, then this will work. And I think the last thing I say, because Buffalo Public Schools will say, yes, this is in our code of conduct, and it is in a code of conduct. Buffalo Public Schools has one of the best code of conducts in the state of New York. It's the implementation that's the struggle. Restorative practice, if you open up the code of conduct and you read the code of conduct, restorative practice is dedicated to the first page of the code of conduct. The problem is the implementation and support. Last thing I'll say, probably not the last thing I'll say, but I will also say we did have the privilege of training their support team. So their counselors, their social workers, and their school counselors, social worker, and school psychologists. We had the opportunity to train them. Over 187 of them we trained with the skill set. But again, after we did the survey, the survey came back and we do believe in this work. We want to do this work. We don't have the time to do this work. So the challenge is time. It is our greatest resource. Time is our greatest resource. But if we don't give the time now, they're going to take the time later. And that is what we're seeing in our suspension data. They're taking the time for the attention one way or another.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so you mentioned different conflicts that might arise that restorative practices can really address. I know we hear in the headlines, you know, when something is egregious and it gets to a point where, you know, there's fight broke out or this serious conflict has happened. And I'm wondering what types of situations can these restorative practices really address, right? Is it serious incidents? Is it smaller, minor incidents? At what point in time are these restorative practices disrupting, I guess, those different incidents?
Well, I think the first thing is that 80% of what we're going to be doing is going to be community building and positive, fun relationship building. So that's where the big lift is, to do that first. That's tier one. Tier two would be like for low level conflict. A kid walks out of class, or you know, a kid gets a write up for a bus referral. We don't need to call, you know, administration. We don't need to call home, but there's a conflict and we want to have a conversation to address it. If we don't, it could continue to escalate. But even for the most serious events, we had a kid brought a knife to school and was suspended, we still had a restorative conversation with people from the community and the district and the student to talk about the harm. But I think the power is that if every teacher had the support and access, we could resolve a lot more conflicts in a classroom and not need to send kids out of a classroom to talk to a second person. So, you know, here's an example, a short story where this ninth grader who was a struggling reader and was in a class where they did a lot of outside reading, and she was always be missing that class for a counseling appointment or for whatever reason was late, and she was embarrassed by her reading in class. So she was missing a lot, and the teacher was frustrated. One day she walks in, and the teacher's like, you know, I'm surprised you're here. Look, and the student was embarrassed and just walks out of class again. And then the kid gets written up for skipping class. We talk to the student, and this kid says, well, the teacher doesn't like me. She makes fun of me. She says she uses sarcastic marks directed at me, and I don't want to be made fun of, so she doesn't like me. And the teacher's feeling that the student's very disruptive and it's hard to teach. And when she's in class, she's off the mark. And so we had to bring them together and we had the student's parent there. And we talked about what was happening. And the teacher didn't realize that those sarcastic comments weren't helping at all. And then also the teacher really didn't realize how often the student felt embarrassed in the class. And so we had to talk about that. And once that was resolved, the student wasn't getting written up anymore. And we could repair that relationship between the student and the teacher. And this idea, when a student says, the teacher doesn't like me, the teacher doesn't say, well, that's not true. The first thing is we need to validate what the kid's feeling and then say, I hear that and you understand that. And let's have a conversation about how we can remedy that a little bit. Because the teacher was very motivated to repair the relationship, and the student wants to pass the class. Mm-hmm. But what we were happening, we were having this low-level conflict that was escalating. Kid was cutting class, and it was steering towards in-school suspension, and we were able to have the conversation and prevent that from happening. And I think what's exciting is that when Dean and I, we worked together in 2013, 2014, at a school, when we introduced this process, that the staff asked for this process 75 times, and we tracked it. And tracking is important because you need to celebrate successes. The next year after we did this, the kids, or the parents and the kids, asked for this process 211 times. So once people know they can ask for the process, the kids would come in. They would seek out Dina, or we have different other people, the phys ed or art teacher. We need to have a conversation. Mm-hmm. Something happened. Okay, we'll do it at lunchtime. And okay, once the kids know we're going to talk about it, they knew that they could get their day together, but this is going to be addressed. Mm-hmm. And that was when it really became, the culture shifted, when families and students knew they could ask for processes, mm-hmm. and they could have some agency in resolving their own problems. And that was really exciting.
I think I want to say, to add to Andy's point, the school to prison pipeline is real. Mm-hmm. We're seeing a vast number of students who are suspended from school and entering into the criminal justice system. And I say that because that is also part of our work. So when you ask the question, you know, how serious can the crime be? Just over the last few weeks, we had a phone call from a different area outside of Western New York seeking assistance for a restorative justice conversation about a person who is in prison, committed a crime, and still wanted a restorative process. He wanted to take accountability and repair the harm. This is a victim-centered approach. So it gives the victim the power to talk about, you know, what does justice look like and what does justice mean for me? And so I say that because the Community Foundation of Greater Buffalo, their Racial Equity Roundtable, invested in ECRJC to come up with creating a program around our youth who are entering into the criminal justice system. And if we can remember around 20, just after COVID, there was an increase in car theft around 21, 22. The Kias were being stolen, and being around the racial equity roundtable had a lot of stakeholders at the table, including the police department, the DA's office, probation, other community support organizations. And we came up with a program that was the three-part series, specifically under the direction of that time it was DA Flynn, coming up and supporting a program. The three-part series really focused on those car cases. It focused on the DA system referring cases to us of youth who were first-time offenders of stealing cars. They referred the cases to us. We did a victim offender mediation. We call them harm and harmer, but for language of for people to understand, we did a harm and harmer a conversation where the victim really told the story about the impact of when you stole my car, I could not get to work. My kids' car seats were in the car. Valuables from my grandmother were in the car. Everything I owned, my computer, everything. I could not function when you stole my car. And the youth and their parents are there. Community members are there. So we're all listening to the impact of this behavior. It gives the youth the ability to take some accountability around that. And some stories that we were finding out is that the youth were stealing cars to sleep with them. Youth were sometimes using the car to help pay for other things. This doesn't excuse behavior, but it does say that there's an underlying issue that is causing behavior. And when we are facing these underlying issues and when we're facing the impact of our decisions to commit a crime, we can come away, both people can come away with something tangible from this conversation. So repairing the harm, the victim gets their answers, their questions answered, they get their safety restored. They don't have to look around and fear that every time they get in a car, it might be stolen, because the answers, the questions they had are answered. There might be something tangible that happens that the youth has to, I don't know, pay the whatever the deductible or something like that. So something like that happens. The underlying issue of homelessness for the youth, mental health services, support for the family, job for the youth, like all of these issues are answered when we bring people together. The second part of the three-part series is because we are around the table is this relationship with the police department, right? And so there's a lot of tension in our relationship with the police department. So we are very particular about lifting up officers who are in and of the community to come together and have a conversation with the youth. They do role playing with the youth, and we come together like, what is our responsibility of both of us keeping the community safe? And what is both of our responsibility in respecting one another on the street, and how do we get support for that?
And so we're going to take a quick break and we'll come right back. We are with Dina Thompson and Andy Prinzing from the Erie County Restorative Justice Coalition.
Public media keeps our community talking and thinking together. Hear perspectives that matter on BTPM NPR. Experience meaningful stories on BTPM PBS. Enjoy performances that connect us on BTPM Classical, and discover new voices on BTPM The Bridge. These are conversations that shape our region and open our world. This is public media. Visit btpm.org.
Trust doesn't happen by accident. It's built through careful reporting, verified facts, and respect for the audience. BTPM NPR's local journalists take the time to get it right, covering the issues shaping Western New York and Southern Ontario.
Immigration consultants like Tatiana Cabrera say they're seeing more interest in people coming to Canada, but warn there are still many hurdles to overcome.
It's not sort of a free-for-all type of an application, but I think it's still worth attempting for many people who see that they have either parent, grandparent, great-grandparent who may have been born in Canada.
UPD responded to a reported serious concern based on credible information and followed established police procedures. According to court filings from police, the students only had a photo to identify the person who made the threats.
News without spin, context without noise. This is public media. You're listening to What's Next, our place to discuss the important issues of our communities of Western New York and Southern Ontario. We want to hear from you. Click on the Talk to Us option in the BTPM Listen app, and we will work to get your questions or comments on the air. Do you have a story or concern that we should be addressing? Email us using whatsnext@btpm.org. Together, we'll have the conversations that are needed. This is Buffalo Toronto Public Media, NPR.
And we're back with What's Next. My name is Akua Menzedu, and we are here with Dina Thompson and Andy Prinzing from the Erie County Restorative Justice Coalition. And so before break, you started to talk about this three-part component of, you know, your work and its importance. Can you just finish that thought?
Sure. So the third part of our three-part series diversion program is really connecting the youth with the community. We know that that is central because our philosophy is if you're taking something out of someone's hand, you have to put something in it. And so to actually change behavior and to move people forward in a positive way, we have to change the culture, to change their involvement, to change their opinion about the community and reintegrate them back into community in a healthy way. This is when our community partners are so important. So usually we connect our youth with a community partner of something that they're interested in. They get to name what they're interested in. It could be a basketball program. It could be a work study program. It could be mental health. It could be family support. So we're connecting them with local organizations that can help build upon their own agency and also build upon their own competency. So we want to build up their skills so that they are recognized as Buffalo's future. Mm-hmm. Lastly, I'll just talk about our other diversion program that is called LORD, Leading with Our Resilience Every Day. We have referrals from the DA's office, from family court, from probation, and from school, and community can also refer LORD candidates to this program. What we found out is doing the three-part series, those underlining issues have a lot to do with mental health. Our youth are looking for mental health support. That is the number one issue that they are looking for is mental health support. Leading Our Resilience Every Day gives voice to some of the things that youth are experiencing, and it brings about their own self-awareness. They can address some of the traumas that they're doing. It gives them self-advocacy, also goal setting and addressing trauma and even anger issues. So it gives them the knowledge to acknowledge how they're feeling and then again acknowledge those feelings and then how to respond to that in positive ways. I'm going to let Andy lead a little bit more on that.
Yeah, I just want to say that the diversion program, I would say it's a community diversion program because we couldn't do this without, mm-hmm. like we've had 31 community different groups over the past 5 years participate. And the community shows up and we're challenging the youth to go from you're more than the worst thing you ever did. Mm-hmm. And so you are not, just because you're involved in a car theft doesn't mean you're a thief, but maybe that's how the kid's feeling. And we want to challenge them through your community involvement is to do something to make the community better because you're an asset. And we see that in you. And you might not be feeling it from day now, but through this experience, we want the students to see themselves as assets. And what's exciting, we've presented for the past 2 years in Albany at the New York State Criminal Justice Symposium because we have like a 75% success rate for kids who go through the program don't end up getting rearrested. And we're hoping to now take this program, and we're excited that we're getting school referrals because we think we can have the same success rate. It's a resiliency program, mm-hmm. but we want kids to have a positive self-image, and we explore conversations like the cycle of risk. We talk about shame. We talk about the roots of behavior. Like everything you do is an attempt to get a need met in a healthy way or an unhealthy way. Oftentimes, whether kids get their needs met in healthy ways is really up to the adults around them. Mm-hmm. Do they have opportunities to get their needs met? And when they don't, we know we're all going to get our needs met. And so we just want to help them to get that need met in a healthy way. But we talk about relationships. We talk a lot about trauma, which is amazing because we're actually talking about that tonight with the group. And every time we've had this conversation, every time we've done it now with 7 groups of kids in the past year, the kids always say, we just thought this was normal. Mm-hmm. And so we talked about the ACEs assessment, and they just thought, no one ever told me, like they didn't realize. And then when you experience, you know, three or four multiple traumatic events as a kid. When you, it happens to you when you're seven, you don't have language to talk about this when you're seven, but you carry this with you into your adulthood and high school years. And so to be able to name it, to understand it, to talk about it, and when you're older, you have some more knowledge and literacy to talk about emotions, we can start healing. And every time we do a circle, every time we build relationships and connection, it's not therapy, but it is a trauma-informed practice. Because if you were to sit with a group of people and talk about something that was like something you experienced, being able to share your story and be listened to is healing. So it is a trauma-informed practice. Even every circle we do, I would say that you're participating in a trauma-informed practice because we're creating connection and understanding. But the success rate is really exciting. We're excited to see how this can also be used with, for example, with like attendance. It's a big issue. And can we have conversations with kids who aren't going to school and help them like reconnect to their core self? And like they need to see that, you know, their true self is good, wise, and powerful, and we can learn some things and then promote this resiliency in everybody. And that's what's really exciting about the program. So it's a social-emotional curriculum for teenagers. Something adults need it too. You know? So we can all learn. I know I knew it. And so every time, and for me, it's a facilitator. It's healing for anyone. And we have community members that join the conversations. It's healing for everybody. Because like my healing is tied to your healing. And I think for kids, they can also understand when they see someone healing, they can heal something in themselves too. So that's what's really contagious about it.
So one of the issues raised in the Attorney General's review was disparities in school discipline. And we started to talk a little bit about that. How can these restorative practices help address those disparities? And I know there's been many conversations as well around, okay, students of color being seen as maybe older than they are, right? Like we know that there's this misconception around how they show maybe anger or, you know, things that are kind of happening on that level. So what do these restorative practices do as it relates to these disparities?
Help me to remember something, just the history, because I said we do racial healing work, right? And so when we go back to history, we recognize that school is not necessarily made for people of color. So it wasn't designed for us to succeed in a system. So we're pushing back in a system, and we're also being seen as, and sometimes maybe it's an unbiased approach, but we're not seen as being belong in the system. So restorative practice is, especially when you're facilitating, it allows you to be neutral and to participate in it. And so you don't have judgment over it. It's the community and the people who are who have been impacted by the particular incident that has that comes up with the agreement to move forward. So it's up to the community to talk about how are we going to make things right. It's not up to the principal assigning it. It's not up to the teachers assigning what has to happen for that justice part to happen. It's about the people who are impacted. So it makes it a fair process because everyone has a voice in how to repair the harm, not just one person. There's not one decision maker. So to me, it's a relief that I don't have to have all the answers at the time. And it's interesting when young people take part in this, because sometimes I feel that young people are harder on themselves than any adult in the room. Like, to repair the harm, I'm going to do this and this and this. I'll give you an example. When Andy and I worked in a school together, we had five sixth graders who were bullying in school, and they were really bullying this one gentleman in particular. And so the bullying, of course, turned into a fight. Suspension was supposed to be the response, but I came in and I said, let's just try a restorative response. So we met and we talked about, again, those questions: what happened, what were you thinking at the time, what have you thought about since, who's been impacted by what happened, what needs to happen to make things right. So upon the parents being involved, the community being involved, and the students being involved, we came up with an agreement. All five of the young men, they happened to be boys, all five of the boys had to do a research project on what bullying meant. They had to present the research project to all of the sixth graders. They had to apologize to the boys who who received the bullying, and then they these sixth graders, it was they drew posters as well. And the amazing thing about the sixth graders in the class is they became like the people that the other students went to and say, hey, so-and-so did this to me. Is that bullying? So they really became leaders within the classroom just through this whole process. And so suspension would have never done that. Suspension would have suspended all the boys. The young man still would have felt scared. The young man still would have felt like the kids didn't like him. The young man still would have felt like not included in the class. And the kids would have came back angry at the young men because they had to not be in school for 5 days or however this suspension is. So it works as this fair process that the people who are closest to the problem is closer to the solution. And I want to be key. It's a community effort. Like, everything does not have to depend on the school to make the decision. So the parents are responsible for making the decision. Community is responsible. And the school system does have a voice in the process to move it forward. And that's what makes it fair. And that's what will reduce the disparities that we're seeing in the data right now.
So why is it important to think about school discipline not just as punishment, but an opportunity for repair and accountability?
Well, I think just the term discipline in its roots, it means to teach. You know, so like when we have every conflict or challenge is an opportunity to learn. But if I'm just excluding someone and removing them from the community, besides putting them more at risk or losing more instruction, we have to ask ourselves, like, where's the learning in that? I think it's only by holding, like, through storytelling, letting people talk about what happened, how they're impacted. And some people also will say that you're giving kids the soft shoulder. This is not about accountability. But until you've sat in the circle and had to take accountability from someone that you created harm to, that is really hard to do. And I will have a short story because we love stories, but this sixth or seventh grade young man said something very sexually inappropriate about one of his classmates, trying to get her attention. But when she went home and told her parents, they called the school the next day and they were wanting to a consequence and wanted to know what was going to happen. And the schools will say, we don't talk about how we're going to discipline other kids. But the parents are like, well, that's not good enough. I'm not going to send my daughter to school if she's not going to be safe. And so we're able to talk to the young man and his mom, and the young man's mom was like, my son said what? Of course we'll come to school and have the conversation. And the kids, his response was, can't you just suspend me? Because he didn't want to sit across from the young woman and her family. Mm-hmm. And we got together. The dad said, every day I put my daughter on a bus to go to school and I think she's going to be safe. It's my job as a dad to keep my daughter safe. He goes, you stole that from me. Mm-hmm. And I don't know what to do. And the kid, the tears just started gushing. Mm-hmm. And afterwards, the dad was like, I don't need you suspended. I need you to understand how hurtful that was. Mm-hmm. And I need to know how that made us feel and the impact of that. And I don't know from your response, I know you're not going to do that again. And that was the learning and holding kids accountable. And that was a really great example of that. And I would just think over and over again, that's something that unless you've had that experience and seen it, people from the outside just think that we're not holding kids accountable, but you need to be a part of it and see how hard it is and to see what the healing and focus on the needs of the people who experience harm. What do they need? Because the code of conduct doesn't say give the people harmed what they need. But if we're going to heal this, we need to ask the people who are most impacted, what is making this right look like to you or to the mom or the dad or the student? And I think that's important.
I just wanted to add to Andy's point, discipline does not mean punishment. Discipline does not have to be punitive. We as adults are supposed to be teaching children in the way that they should go so they don't depart from it, right? That us being punitive and sending people away is not teaching them. It's just sending them away and they're just going to think about how they've been the victim of this particular situation. Our opportunity through restorative practices is teaching discipline. It's still discipline. We're just teaching them how to move forward in a positive way.
So we have about 2 minutes before we're going to take a break. I want to talk a little bit more about misconceptions of what restorative practices are, because like you said, many folks think, oh, you know, they're just getting off or getting an easy route. What other misconceptions do you hear in your work?
I think people think that it's a curriculum.
Okay.
It's not a curriculum. It's an approach. and it's based on beliefs about people. So like, for example, it's also like an indigenous practice based on indigenous teachings from First Nations in Canada, but it's indigenous to us all. If we all traced our own ancestry back to parents, grandparents, hundreds of years, this is something that communities did when harm happened. And these teachings or these beliefs are things like, we believe the true self in everybody is good, wise, and powerful. That's number one. Number two is everything we need to make positive change is right here with the group of people that are talking about it. A third one is everyone is welcome for the gifts that they bring. So I think these are beliefs about people. And ask you, if you can ask yourself, is did you feel that way when you were in school? Did you feel good, wise, and powerful? And if that's not the case, then there's more work to do. And also, the teacher prep programs, the colleges, need to start lifting this up. Because you can be a great science teacher. It doesn't mean you can teach this group of kids. And we need to ask, one of the first questions is, can you have relationships with every one of your students? Mm-hmm. And if you can, great. And if you can't, this is going to be really hard, or this might not be a really good fit, because without a significant relationship, we can't have really significant learning, and relationships are going to have a huge impact in all of our schools. So that's the first thing, is just that it's not a curriculum. It really is a mindset. What do we believe about people? What do you believe about your students, their families, and your colleagues? Do you believe all your colleagues are good, wise, and powerful people?
And this is What's Next. We will be right back after a break.
Buffalo, Toronto Public Media, NPR, brings you trusted, local journalism every day. Our reporters are in your communities covering the stories that shape Western New York and Southern Ontario. The issues, people, and decisions that matter. Add national perspective from the BBC and Here and Now, and you're connected to the larger world without losing sight of home. Stay informed with reporting that you can trust on BTPM NPR.
Buffalo, Toronto Public Media brings our community together with programs that inspire, inform, and entertain. Enjoy trusted news, local performances, educational resources, and cultural treasures all in one place. It's more than media. It's a connection to the world around you. Discover what Buffalo, Toronto Public Media offers at btpm.org. This is Public Media.
Corey here with the Compact Civics Expansion Pack.
America is such a big, wide, awesome place, and to be able to see things that are representative of so many different places, it can be so important when brought to your tiny town.
Everybody is so kind and loving. I'm here in Buffalo just because of Stage Buffalo.
From urban farms to rural fairs, we'll celebrate spaces that bring us together and create community.
Watch on the Buffalo Toronto Public Media YouTube channel.
You're listening to What's Next, our place to discuss the important issues of our communities of Western New York and Southern Ontario. We want to hear from you. Click on the Talk to Us option in the BTPM Listen app, and we will work to get your questions or comments on the air. Do you have a story or concern that we should be addressing? Email us using whatsnext@btpm.org. Together, we'll have the conversations that are needed. This is Buffalo, Toronto Public Media, NPR.
And we're back with What's Next. My name is Akua Menzedu, and we're with Dina Thompson and Andy Prinzing from Erie County Restorative Justice Coalition. And I want to talk a little bit about how this is more than just a school issue, right? We talk about the community's importance in this work. What does that look like in terms of collaboration?
Well, I think the first thing is when you think about student success, I think historically we look at the schools as being 100% responsible for the success of students. But I think a successful student, really, you know, the old adage, it takes a village. We need to include, it's a community issue, it's a social issue. So including as much as possible, you know, parent voices or just voices of other community groups, whether it's a faith community, a community center, a youth program. I mean, there's all these excellent programs that work with youth around the city, Most Valuable Parent, Peace Prince, Peace of the City. I mean, you could rattle off
the Foundry.
Mm-hmm. I mean, there's so many, but we're always like, we're compartmentalizing our work. And if we could just have a conversation about, like, if there is a serious incident of harm and we're having a reentry meeting, it's not just the principal talking to the kid and the parent. Let's bring in If they are working with a community group, bring them in. If they're not, let's get them hooked up with a community group. Because when the community, one thing we've learned, when the community shows up, great things happen. Yeah. And the community shows up to support the youth, the family, and the school. And they're just coming with an open hand. And so that's one thing that always, it's good for us to keep remembering this because we can forget it and we can just get in our silo. But I would think it would be very refreshing if we just said, we're going to take a community approach. We're going to double down and we're going to open up the conversation and invite more people in to help kids.
I love to think out that, so I'm a Cold Spring girl. So, so growing up on the east side of Buffalo where everybody could parent you, right? Like you could not run down the street and do something because before you ran back home, like the lady down the street already told your mother what you did. Right. I think when I think about community, I think about that. That's what I think. Like it takes all of us. And so they're not their children. They're our children. And then when we begin to take the ownership as community and community groups that they are all ours, we can scaffold the needs of families. And so right now I might need a basketball program, tomorrow I might need tutoring. And so if we stop looking at the siloed needs of people, because we have multiple needs, I mean, our world is changing every single day. And so the needs that we have, I like to call it Circle City, because of in a circle, nothing is missing and nothing is broken, but there's an equality in the circle. In the circle, everything we have is right there. And so as a community, if we can scaffold the needs and meet the needs of everyone within that community, then the community is stronger. And when we begin to see and take ownership of each other's struggles, conflict. We're taking ownership. It's not their struggle. It's not their it's not their conflict. It's not that person that did the crime. It's a crime in our community. And as a community, we need to come together and be able to solve that. Punishment has not resolved crime. The United States of America has the highest incarceration rate. Like, Buffalo has the highest suspension rate. It is not making us feel safer. And so what does make it us feel safer is, to Andy's point, is how we feel in community. When we feel like when we belong to that community, when we are giving back to that community. So the community is important in keeping us all safe. It's all of our duty to do that. The community is important for supplying the needs that we have to build and grow and to be our best self. And so we are in need of each other, just like that it takes a village. And we need to go back to that Sankofa and remember and grab that seed. And we need to bring that seed of it takes a village mentality, that Cold Spring mentality, and bring it into the future and meet the needs of our not only students, but meet the needs of our families.
And I think, you know, when we talk about things like culture within schools, we know that culture should be owned by everyone as well, right? Mm-hmm. And so it's not just a principal or a specific teacher. It's everyone inside of that building. And so how do you make this stick, right? We talked about the time limitations within the school system. How do we make sure that this is something that continues forward?
I feel like time is an investment, right? Kids will take time from you one way or another. Mm-hmm. We have an option to positively give students, families, our time in positive ways. We need to make that investment, because the investment that we make with our time will give us the biggest return. So if I'm giving students 15 minutes, 20 minutes in the morning in the classroom to get it all out, to connect with each other, that's my investment. It might take away 15 minutes from my math lesson, but guess what? 3 weeks, one week down the line, I'm not going to have that same problem that I might have had. I'm not going to have the conflict, because I know our students. I know I can give my students a look. So when Andy said, like, when I was the person that students went to in school, I would walk in the classroom, just give a look, right? And because I had the relationship with students, they would just stop. And so that is what happens when you begin to build that relationship. So we have to make that investment. Say, yes, it's costing us something right now, but the benefit in the future is going to benefit every single student and every single family. So we cannot afford not to make this happen within our Buffalo public school systems if we want to see the success and the academic success, the safety success, the cultural success, the success of building relationships in our school. My last thing I will say, restore people. To Andy's point, if we're not investing in the leadership, if we're not investing in the staff, if we're not investing in the support staff in our school systems, this is not going to work either.
So we have 1 minute left. Okay. I just want y'all, you know, what do you want people to take away from this conversation? Obviously, there's been, you know, this conversation that's happening at that larger level, the Attorney General's office. What do people need to know?
I think we know that traditional justice, our criminal justice system and schools justice, they kind of mirror each other. You know, when harm happens, it's like there's an investigation, who did it? We assign a consequence, and justice is the consequence. And our codes of conduct, we have the code of conduct. If you get into a fight, you could be suspended up to 5 days to a formal hearing. So that's what we're going by. A restorative mindset, the first question we ask is what happened, who was harmed, and what's the plan to repair the harm? And then we need to ask ourselves, is the suspension going to do any of that? And we need to focus on the needs of the people who were hurt and start there. And I think so. It's we're changing the lens or changing questions. Howard Zaire wrote about it in his book about restorative practices. We're looking at the conflict through a different lens. And we're not meant to replace the traditional system, but these things work hand in hand. Because sometimes we can find an alternative, and sometimes we have to go with the traditional method. But even if a kid is suspended, we can still repair relationships when they come back.
And then how do folks request this service?
Through Erie County Restorative Justice Coalition, you just go to our website, ecrjc.org. That's ecrjc.org. And I just wanted to, my last thing is just a comment on the last thing you said, just leaving us with the famous question from the Mighty Maasai Warriors, and how are the children? Are the children well? And I think we just need to keep asking ourselves that question. How are the children? Are the children well?
Absolutely. And so I want to thank you both for coming on. We were joined with joined by Dina Thompson, who is the executive director, and Andy Prinzing, who is the director of training for the Erie County Restorative Justice Coalition.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Support for WBFO and What's Next comes from our members. And from Health Foundation for Western and Central New York, where racial and socioeconomic health equity are prioritized. Learn more about building healthier neighborhoods at hfwcny.org.